Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu and the legislature are at odds over the state budget. The large field of Democratic candidates for president grows by one more, with Ohio Representative Tim Ryan declaring this week. And investigators try to put to rest a possible lead in the 2004 disappearance of Maura Murray. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange, all one word. And we are also broadcasting a live video of this radio show today, and you can watch that at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landrigan, reporter for the Union Leader, Jackie Benson, editor at Citizens Count. And for the first part of the program today, NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Hey, Peter.
So again, listeners, phone number for you to call to join the conversation about the week's news, 1-800-892-6477. And of course, the big news this week is negotiations about the state budget. Democrats want to do a variety of things in the budget they passed in the legislature. So let's look at a few of those things. And Josh, maybe you can help us out with this. First of all, the state psychiatric hospital, the governor wanted $26 million for this, but the Democrats said no. Why don't they want this?
Well, there's a difference of opinion on how best to fulfill the 10-year mental health plan. Democrats say that the governor's proposal didn't have the detail they wanted. There was also some discomfort with the fact that it sought to do it out of the general fund of the budget and not as part of the capital budget process, where you would have more detail, more planning. They're not necessarily opposed to this idea. And if you recall, when the governor announced that he intended to close a secure psychiatric unit behind the walls of the state prison, there was standing ovation, a real bipartisan moment in a not terribly bipartisan year thus far. And this has been a priority for Democrats, mainly on a kind of humanitarian level, that they don't think it's appropriate that New Hampshire's only secure psychiatric hospital is on the grounds of the state prison. You know, we'll see where this goes in the Senate. The budget still has to pass on the House floor. Everyone's expecting it to do so. This is a budget in committee. The Senate will get its turn with the budget. It would not be shocking for this to return in the Senate proposal. I mean, the kind of night is young in terms of the budget, frankly. Mm-hmm.
And at a press conference at Concord Hospital this week, Governor Sununu explained his approach to making changes in New Hampshire's mental health system.
This is unprecedented. This isn't just some bump in the road we're hitting. We need to rebuild an infrastructure for the long term here. So absolutely, we're going to move fast. And we are not going to let bureaucracy, which has slowed this process down for 20 years, continue for another 10.
And Governor Sununu also described the process as a multi-pronged effort.
Today, we have the opportunity to move all of these dominoes at once, to move it very, very quickly. This is going to take some time to get built, right? You have to start. Government shouldn't always move in series. Sometimes it has to move in parallel, right? And this is the opportunity to move a lot of these projects in parallel with kids, with the secure psychiatric unit, the capacity at a New Hampshire hospital, the county jails, the community beds. All of this can start moving at once.
So, Jackie Benson, how do you see this debate over the state psychiatric hospital moving forward?
Well, it's interesting because, one of the major motivators for the House sort of changing this aspect of the budget was advocacy from the Disability Rights Center, who came in and basically said, we're afraid that if you build this whole new facility, it's going to result in more institutionalization of mental health patients. And what we would rather see is more funding going to community services. So the House budget writers are supporting that perspective, and they're arguing that by building a secure facility within New Hampshire Hospital will be able to spend more money on sort of maybe mobile crisis units or things like that in a community setting. So whether the senator is going to go along with that or not, and how, I mean, Sununu's made it very clear that he wants that building. So, I mean, we're definitely looking at a showdown here, and it'll be interesting to see which way the Senate goes.
Dean.
Yeah, Josh is right. We still are relatively early in the budget process as it typically plays out. The Senate could take it in a very different direction, and they have until June 20th to reach an agreement. It was a little bit of a surprise. There was this tremendous amount of bipartisan support for the idea of a new secure psychiatric facility to get people out of the prison system and into more of a hospital setting. But Jackie is also right. There is a philosophical difference about whether to build another centralized facility or focus the money on transitioning people to community-based treatment. You know, in the bigger picture, this really feels like a Democratic budget. It's got a new capital gains tax. It's halting Governor Sununu's business tax reductions. It's swapping in the Democratic family medical leave plan for Sununu's two-state plan with Vermont. So there are a number of markings on this budget that are clearly Democratic, which is what you would expect. And now we'll see what the Senate does.
Well, Josh, I wanted to ask you about the capital gains tax that the Democrats are proposing. How much are they hoping to raise from this?
Well, $150 million in year two of the budget, and they've created in such a way where they say it's really going to hit only people with a good deal of money. Whether that flies in the state Senate is, you know, it's touchy. The Senate Finance Committee Chairman Lou D'Alessandro said that he's not in favor of this, and we'll see what happens there. The governor's certainly not going to be in favor of this. You know, and the business tax reductions are something that the governor said he absolutely wants. And, you know, there's a lot of early signals that this budget could be vetoed. You know, the last time a budget was vetoed was then-Governor Hassan. It was when she faced a Republican legislature, when she was gearing up for a Senate run. And, you know, as Kevin will recall, budgets don't get vetoed too often. And, you know, some people thought that vetoing a budget could be politically fraught. It didn't prove to be for her. And, you know, if you look at the situation for Governor Sununu, you know, if we ended up with a continuing resolution, we would end up with the rainy day fund filled. We would end up with a budget that, you know, he's comfortable with. And so, you know, I don't know. I'd be curious to know what Kevin thinks.
Yeah, I think that's true, Josh. I mean, what's unusual about this is to have these kind of battle lines drawn this early. Even when Hassan was fighting with Republicans in 2015, you'll recall, there weren't a lot of disagreements about specifics. It was really all about revenue estimating and these business tax cuts that Republicans wanted to adopt, and Hassan said at the time, just weren't affordable the way they proposed them. They met a middle ground even after the veto and ultimately came up with a permanent budget. That could happen here. Sununu's problem, particularly with the psych hospital, is we've alluded to the Senate, is the Senate has been extremely well-disciplined, the Democratic majority. So now he realizes the psych hospital is not going to be in the House budget. He's got to somehow get some kind of place setter into the Senate budget, or he has no position when they start negotiating a compromise. A lot of this is all about hostage taking, right? Because at the end of the day, the House Democrats have their priorities, and in order to achieve them and pay for them, they have to actually take some of Sununu's priorities off the table. That's what they've done here. Their priorities are increasing education aid grants for property-poor communities and also restoring revenue sharing. Even with a capital gains tax, you got to take some spending out if you want to do those
things. And he is poking them. The Democrats are poking him a little bit. He had that great announcement about the $168 or $164 million in one-time local projects, and I think almost all of that money has been taken out, at least $100 million, by Democrats. So they're, you know, clearly they are drawing some battle lines here. But as you have all mentioned, the Senate is a very different process.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting is that as I've been kind of monitoring the legislative process here and watching some of these bills coming along, like HB 686, which was the capital gains tax bill, and SB 1, which was family and medical leave. Now they're not bills; they're now in the budget. So it's as though the House budget writers have deliberately decided these are policies that are so important to us. We want to make sure that they're trying to make it harder, you know, for Sununu to just kind of toss out the particular programs they know he's going to have opposition to. So I don't know. This feels like a game of poker to me a little bit.
Yeah, more like chicken, right?
Right. I mean,
in other words, you make this grand bargain. You put everything into this bill that he's either got to sign, veto, or throw up his hands and say try again. While if you send him 25 different bills that he vetoes, he's got enough Republicans in both chambers to sustain almost all of them.
Yeah, and this so it comes down to are they doing this knowing that they're basically putting in their kind of highball offer on the table here, and now we're gonna see it maybe a process of negotiation where we try to find a common ground. That'd be and the Senate may be the place where that happens, or it may be happening after that veto pen has been wielded.
Yeah, well, what's really interesting about the House budget dynamic, right? And Josh, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. Is they've got a real challenge here because they adopt a very progressive liberal budget. They send it over to the Senate, maybe gets chipped away. How are the new House Democrats, many of them liberal, going to be reacting to a lot of their pet programs being taken out of a compromise? I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, it is hard to know. I mean, one thing to bear in mind in the Senate, and I was in the Senate Finance Committee, they're going to obviously get their turn with the budget quite shortly, and they were getting a presentation from the Revenue Commissioner, Lindsay Stepp, and she said, you know, the surging business tax receipts, at this point, most people acknowledge that it's largely due to changes at the federal level, but that, you know, she was expecting collections have been continuing to be above projection significantly. She was expecting that to go down in April when a lot of business tax numbers come in. But she said that her office estimates that there was up to $100 million worth of business tax collections last year that won't be repeated this year. And, you know, how that changes the calculus for revenue estimating in the Senate. And, you know, another issue is gambling. You know, the Senate passed gambling and, you know, the House has never passed gambling. Lou D'Alessandro, I was speaking with him, the Senate's top budget writer, and, you know, he's obviously deeply invested in gambling happening. You know, he says that he believes that, you know, this has a chance because this is something that the governor is less clearly opposed to than all the revenue options that Democrats have put on the table in the House. So, you know, we're a long ways to go. And I do think Kevin makes an interesting point. We don't know. There is absolute discipline among Senate Democrats. We don't really know if that's the case among House Democrats, if they get angry if things get moved out of the budget ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Income from the state lottery is also part of the budget, but that may be affected by this federal ruling on whether it's legal. So how are lawmakers dealing with uncertainty over that?
Well, I mean, that's good. The state's suing over that. This has to do with how the Trump Justice Department is interpreting the Wire Act and whether or not, you know, and then Charlie McIntyre, who's the head of the lottery, testified to the Senate that, you know, the worst case scenario, this would invalidate the entire lottery. And I don't think many people believe that would be the case. Certainly, there's $10 million that they were projecting to get from online lottery that is probably not going to happen. But it would seem far-fetched, although, you know, it would seem far-fetched that all of the lottery commissioners is going to become invalidated. But the state has been joined by, I think, about a dozen other states, and there's going to be a hearing in federal court in Concord next week.
Okay. So Jackie, what will you be looking for going forward with respect to the debate over the budget?
Well, I'm really interested to see what's going to go on with the school funding formula that they've put in here. So the whole point of the capital gains tax is to increase funding for schools, and
that's $150 million.
Right. Yeah. And so the House, you know, budget included a new formula that is meant to be kind of temporary, and it as I believe it was Kevin who was saying, it's specifically focused on providing a lot more money for towns that have a lot of kids on free and reduced lunch, towns that have like a low or equalized property valuation per student. So it'll be interesting to see if the Senate kind of follows suit and keeps that general formula. There's been so many different kind of formulas on the table this year for increasing education funding, and now we've got this lawsuit coming down the pipeline. Conval, and I believe there's two other districts out there in the Monadnock region that have gotten on board with that, and Andrew Valinsky's running around the state seeing if he can drum up some more. You know, so there's going to be potentially a pretty powerful legal imperative for the state to take action on this quickly. And Sununu's original budget didn't have, you know, he had quite a bit for school building aid, but he wasn't doing much. He raised some extra money for special education, but he wasn't doing as much for the issue of the sort of.
Well, he doesn't want to build. I mean, he said very clearly he doesn't want to build ongoing costs into the budget. He's happy to take the money. I mean, their surplus is large by New Hampshire standards. You know, send that out to the communities. I mean, he memorably said he downshifts cash to communities. you know, he wants to do it in one time fashion. You know, it is an interesting point. I mean, I do think that if we get down to it, I mean, Democrats are going to say, you know, to communities, look, if the governor doesn't pass this budget, you're going to be missing out on this money, this money, this money. And you know, they think that's going to be powerful.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 1-800-892-6477. And Dean, you wanted to
weigh in? Yeah, a couple quick comments. And, you know, to respond to what Josh just said, I think, you know, one of the concerns among Republicans is that, you know, maybe you have these one-time payments to localities or different projects, but their concern would be that Democrats not build it into a budget in a way that will in the future mean ongoing obligations that have to be funded. This sort of kind of an unfunded mandate almost. And that's, so I've heard that political argument a lot. You know, for me going forward, I always like to look at revenue policy, this issue of taxes, of the, you know, what do we do about business tax cuts? Do you halt them? Do you roll them back? The capital gains tax. Sununu and Republicans now refer to family medical leave, the Democratic proposal, as an income tax. Shows you how far that debate has kind of, that's idea of consensus on that issue has really fallen apart in recent months. So there's just central philosophical differences about how you raise money and how you spend it. And you can usually see that when you look at things like capital gains, business taxes, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Also this week, the New Hampshire House has passed a bill to limit the carrying of guns on school property. The bill passed on a vote of 213 to 159, and it would restrict the carrying of firearms on school property to law enforcement, members of the military, and people authorized by the local school board. So, Josh, with respect to this bill, was it a fairly standard battle between the parties on gun legislation?
Yes. You know, Democrats ran on what they like to call common sense gun laws. And this, I think, is something that, you know, Democrats were behind. There were some, on gun issues, there's always a little bit of, you know, party line crossing. But I think this kind of went through as expected. I mean, you know, Governor Sununu remains a bit of a mystery on this one. I mean, he's said he's comfortable with the gun laws as they exist. You can take that as a signal that this could potentially be vetoed, but, you know, hard to know on this.
Yeah, it's interesting. We ended up playing a little. This is a bit of a did you know. You know, my colleagues and I over at Citizens Count had to do quite a bit of digging to kind of clear this up. But the legal rules for whether you can carry a gun in a school in New Hampshire right now basically come down to, if you have a permit, if you have a concealed carry permit, then if you are not a student in the school, you can bring a gun. And towns cannot prohibit that. State school districts can't, because obviously here in New Hampshire, we reserve the right for any kind of rules on firearms for the state level. So this came up, I remember, when it was in the last election, because a lot of the schools are polling places. And mm-hmm. Everybody was kind of talking about, well, does this mean that people are going to be able to kind of bring their gun into the school when they come to vote? And the answer was, well, if they have a permit, yes,
well,
they can.
Well, when permitless carry was created, this also
right. Yeah. So the debate on the bill, you know, to some extent, they're kind of framing it as, well, this doesn't really change anything, you know. But in fact, it does. And there was a rival policy, too, that was up for discussion, which would have just given the power to kind of decide policy on guns in schools to the individual districts. And that got killed pretty quickly in favor of this one.
Yeah, this issue has really become a litmus test for Republicans and Democrats. I would be surprised if Governor Sununu would sign this should it pass. And whenever I talk to people about this issue and they're trying to figure out kind of where they are on it, then I ask them a simple question. If you're in a if you're at your child's school and you're at a school concert or something, knowing that a number of parents around you are probably carrying concealed weapons, does that make you feel more safe or less safe? And how you answer that really kind of gives you a sense of where you come down on the issue. And so I think this fits into the larger debate we've had, certainly going back to Sandy Hook, but even further, about whether having more people armed is a solution or a recipe for additional problems. And that's a real sharp divide among Republicans and Democrats on that. And it's very hard to move people off of their preference for one side or the other.
And supporters of the Second Amendment would point out there have been serious school shootings in dozens of states all over this country. There's never been one in New Hampshire. And they argue this is one of the reasons, is because even serious criminal offenders recognize when they go onto school property, they're not sure who has a weapon and who doesn't. So it creates its own safer climate, although it does make people uncomfortable.
Listeners, give us a call if you have a question or comment about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477. One more bit of legislative news to talk about before the break, and that's that legalization, regulation, and taxation of cannabis and cannabis products for adults over the age of 21 passed the House in a 200-163 roll call vote. The marijuana legislation did not get enough votes to override a promised veto. Kate Frye of New Futures told WMUR she thinks support is waning.
We are pleased to see that that number in the votes has gone down since last time, and I think people are understanding that this commercializes another addictive drug.
So she raises the question, you know, if support is waning, why? Josh, what do you think? Why is support waning for this?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure I think the vote in February was 209 to 147 in the House.
So it's not much.
That's not a huge thing. I mean, yeah. she doesn't want this bill to pass, so right. That's what she's going to say. And, you know, we don't know. I mean, interestingly, the taxation mechanism part of this bill did change. And, you know, you could hear, I mean, Dean talked about the way in which the debate over taxation is. I mean, you know, it now includes what can be called a sales tax and whether or not that actually leeches some Republican support from this. It used to just be a tax on wholesale transaction. At 30 an ounce on the original bill. I think it's been changed to 5% on wholesale transactions, 9% on retail transactions. This would put the state in a position to potentially raise some more money off of selling marijuana than the original bill. But, you know, it creates this, you know, marijuana legalization has been pretty popular with Republicans in New Hampshire. And whether or not this tax change changes that is something that to look for.
Dean?
Yeah, it's clearly, I think Josh is right. I think it's a combination of debate over how you tax it and how much money that would bring in and whether or not the estimates that are being put forth, I don't know if it's 20 or 30 million a year, something like that, whether those are accurate or not, or if they overstate the benefit. And, you know, there are now 10 states, I believe, in the United States who have legalized it in some fashion, including Massachusetts, Vermont, and Maine. And so this is starting to have a little bit of the kind of casino gambling feel to it, where we have this debate every year and all the states around us are moving towards it. And in theory, for supporters, siphoning off revenue. And the other side of the argument is the argument about whether or not it's a gateway drug to harder usage opioids and other heroin and other types of issues. There's a real debate about that. People who support it say that it actually can help pull you out of those harder drugs. I don't know the science well enough to weigh in one way or the other, but I'm hearing both arguments.
Well, it's a debate that is going to continue for sure. I want to thank NHPR's senior political reporter Josh Rogers for joining us this part of the program. Thanks very much, Josh.
No problem, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and still to come, we're going to talk about the race for president. 2020 candidates are coming to New Hampshire, and the crowded field of Democrats grew by one more this week. And we'll learn about Tim Ryan, Representative Tim Ryan of Ohio. We'll also talk about Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, and also a Republican fundraiser headlined by Laura Trump. That's coming up on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll be right back.
The New Hampshire Supreme Court has said the state must provide an adequate education to every child. What exactly that means is up for debate.
You're confusing what the definition of an adequate education is and what school districts are actually spending for bells and whistles.
People are really at the end of a road here that I think needs a change.
I'm Sarah Gibson. Listen for Adequate, a new series about how the state decides the value of public education. Thursdays on Morning Edition, only on NHPR.
On Monday on The Exchange, we'll be talking about a new book, Accidental Presidents, about the 8 times in U.S. history that a vice president succeeded to office upon the death of a president. I believe, Dean Spiliotis, you're hosting the show on Monday,
yes,
right?
Yes, indeed. I will be here on Monday to talk with Jared Cohn, the author of that book.
Excellent. Well, right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with Mihar Dean, as he usually is. Also here, Kevin Landrigan, reporter for the Union Leader, and Jackie Benson, editor at Citizens Count. Let's talk about 2020, because why not, right? We're in New Hampshire. The primary is a little less than a year away, but candidates are coming through. And in fact, the crowded field of Democrats is growing still. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan has declared that he's running. He announced yesterday, or rather this week, on The View. Dean, what can you tell us about Tim Ryan?
Sure. Well, Tim Ryan is, as you mentioned, he's a congressman from Ohio. He represents a district that encompasses northeastern Ohio, so Youngstown to Akron, that area. He's 45. Interesting local connection. He received his JD from Franklin Pierce, now UNH School of Law. So we have a local Concord connection there. He's 45. He's been in Congress since 2003. He's considered to be, by the current field standards, a Democratic moderate. He would appeal to a lot of the blue-collar whites in the Midwest who are in the kind of Rust Belt area that he represents. For me, the most interesting thing is that he was an early critic of Nancy Pelosi going back a number of years, and he was someone who was kind of floating himself as an alternative leader in the House. It never quite materialized, and, you know, you could argue now that Nancy Pelosi is stronger than ever as Speaker, but there was a time where he was kind of out there saying she needed to go.
Do you recall why?
He just felt it was a generational argument. I mean, a lot of people were down on her before the most recent election when she was a minority leader, that, you know, that the leadership in the Democratic Party in the House was too old, a group of people in their 70s that you needed to kind of a fresh perspective and certainly more representation. If you think of the House leadership is really from the coasts, Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi, so someone from the heartland. And he kind of put himself out there. I remember he got a lot of criticism, never quite worked out for him. You know, the biggest concern that he may have going forward is he's one of a number, you know, the Democratic field is increasingly progressive. It's very focused on diversity in candidacies, and he's potentially a third or fourth, you know, kind of white guy from the House of Representatives. You got him, potentially Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, Eric Swalwell from California. These guys are all sort of late 30s, mid 40s. I'm not going to say they're interchangeable, but they're all kind of in the same area in terms of being moderate. So it's a very different time. He's not getting the kind of attention that he got a few years ago when he was going after Pelosi. But we'll see if he can step into the action here.
Well, here's Tim Ryan talking about his platform on The View, responding to a question about the Mueller report.
I think we need transparency. Article 1 created the Congress, and the Congress governs. It's closest to the people, so it has a right for these documents, including President Trump's taxes. We need to immediately get back on an economic message on how we're going to help working class people with their health care, the environmental issues, jobs, 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 wages, wages, wages. I think as Democrats, I'm for the fight for 15. I believe we do need to raise the minimum wage, but we can't be saying we're for 15. We need $30 an hour jobs, $40 an hour jobs.
So that's Tim Ryan speaking about his platform on The View. Kevin, I want to hear from you on what you think Tim Ryan adds to the slate of Democratic candidates. Is there anything that he adds that no other candidate does?
Well, it's hard to say. We've got such an eclectic bunch here, but to be sure, he comes from a part of the country very few people in this race do come from, the heartland, the Midwest, states that Democrats desperately need to win if they're going to beat an incumbent president. When Senator Sherrod Brown decided not to run, I think that tipped the signal to Tim Ryan that there was a lane here open. He talks about that he was motivated to run, particularly because of the GM plant closings and talking to friends and associates who had lost their jobs there, great-paying jobs at car manufacturers that may well never come back. And they certainly blame President Trump for some of those plant closings. So I think that's going to be his message. It's going to be very, like Dean said, center-left, but very populist in nature. Like I said, like Senator Brown had articulated in his Dignity to Work campaign before he decided not to run. He adds another voice, but I think it's pretty late to just jump into the campaign now all at once. As we saw this week, we've got half a dozen candidates here who've raised millions of dollars already to run for this office, and he's just getting started.
Well, listeners, we'd love to give you an opportunity to talk about the 2020 primary as it takes more and more a center spot on our minds here in New Hampshire. So what are you thinking about when it comes to the 2020 candidates? Are you frustrated that the field is so large? Are you excited that it's so large? Are there a few candidates that you really are excited to see when they come through? Give us a call now. We'd love to hear from you on this. The number is 1-800-892-8255. 6477. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Or if you're near a computer right now, you can head on over to our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. You can watch a live video of this radio program and also leave a comment, and we can perhaps get your question answered by our panelists here. Again, phone number 1-800-892-6477. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg is stopping in New Hampshire today and tomorrow. And he seems to be having kind of a moment right now. Folks are saying he's a fresh face outside the Beltway, young, smart, capable. And he, of course, seems to be kind of the opposite of everything President Donald Trump embodies. So start with you, Dean. What do you make of Mayor Pete Buttigieg?
He's absolutely having a moment. He reported for the first quarter raising $7 million, which is a very respectable total for someone who is not particularly well known prior to getting into the ring. Some, you know, close political observers will remember that he threw his hat in the ring for the DNC chair the last time around with Keith Ellison and Tom Perez, who now is the chair of the DNC. So that was my first real glimpse of him. He's got quite a resume. I believe he went to Harvard. He's an Afghanistan war veteran. He's a Rhodes Scholar and also mayor of South Bend, Indiana. It's an interesting mix. He's 37. He's gay. He's married. It would be a lot of firsts for a president of the United States. Getting great press, he's earned it. He's done really good TV appearances that have gotten people's interest. To give you a sense of that, he's going to be here this weekend. They had to move the Manchester venue to the Courier Museum. I guess they're going to use the central atrium there because there's such a demand to see him. He's also going to be here, I think, Saturday morning at Gibson's bookstore. Mm-hmm. So my guess is he's going to draw big crowds.
That's always a good thing for a campaign to have to say.
We had to move the venue.
We picked the small venue at first. Yes. Now we need a larger venue because our candidate is just so popular.
Exactly.
So Kevin Landrigan, what do you think?
I think he's certainly got some potential, as a lot of these candidates do. I think a lot of what's happening here, why does this feel so large and why is it expanding? Because there are a lot of people in this race who don't think the two co-front runners are going to win the nomination, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. And because they don't, they feel there is a lane for them, a voice that if they can articulate it and catch fire, they can actually go on and win this nomination. And Buttigieg is one of the first to kind of come out of nowhere, so to speak. Nobody gave this guy any chance when he first announced, what is this guy, a mayor of South Bend, Indiana, thinking he can be president of the United States? But he's very articulate. He's very forceful. He speaks truth to power. He's unafraid of some of the conventional safe statements that a lot of candidates running for president are told to make. And that does inspire a lot of the activists in this party.
Yeah, I think Kevin's kind of nailed it here. It's that, you know, with Biden and Sanders were kind of the potential, ready to step in and get the crown put on their head here as Democratic nominees. And I believe that there's really an appetite within the party this year to not necessarily see, to be frank, another white, older, straight man carrying the torch of the party. You know, we're seeing such a diversity of backgrounds and people coming from all different sort of ages and areas of the country and races and genders and gender orientation. And it's just I think that that's why we're seeing such a crowded field. And nobody yet, I'd say that among those, I mean, Buttigieg has kind of been a nice surprise. It's been really interesting to see a mayor kind of all of a sudden emerge as this really viable candidate. But I would say that I don't think that we have I couldn't even guess right now which of these kind of other candidates is going to emerge as the real powerhouse. It just seems like every week there's a different emphasis on somebody, and that's fun to watch. You know, it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, it's interesting. There clearly is a generational shift here going on. Although Bernie Sanders does quite well among the youngest voting demographic, so it's not purely a change, but there is a change nonetheless. And just to kind of highlight this, Pete Buttigieg could run for president in 40 years. And would be the age that Bernie Sanders is now. That gives you a 40 years age difference. It gives you a sense of the generational breadth of the field. And then you have a number of other people. We just mentioned Tim Ryan and others who Beto O'Rourke and others who are kind of in the early mid 40s range ish. So there are plenty of younger candidates in addition to the folks in their 70s.
I want to get to the calls in a moment, but first I want to ask you, Dean, and then maybe you, Jackie, what do you think about the appetite for a candidate who is outside the Beltway, not really working in Washington. Since we're talking about Pete Buttigieg, he would be one of those candidates. Just thinking, John Hickenlooper, governor of Colorado, would be another one of those candidates. Is there an appetite for someone who's just not in the thick of things in Washington already?
Well, you know, typically most presidential candidates like to run for outsiders, even if they're insiders.
Yeah.
John McCain famously ran as kind of an outsider maverick, even though he was in Washington going back all the way to the 1980s. You know, the typical template for a Democratic nominee or a nominee in general for a long time had been a governor, a white male governor who can run as an outsider. You know, in some respects, we've moved in that direction to the point where Trump really was kind of the ultimate outsider, really kind of detached from any kind of governing background at all. So things that have definitely changed. It's interesting to me to see so many members of Congress running, given that typically it's been more difficult in recent cycles, other than Barack Obama, for members of Congress. I think only one member of the House has ever been elected directly to the presidency. So for the folks in the House like Tim Ryan, that's going to be a real challenge. It's typically, as I said, it's been governors or other people who can run as outsiders. So that's always been part of the ethos. So it's actually interesting to see so many people who are in Congress throwing their hat in the ring.
Jackie?
Yeah, I think that honestly, it's almost less about an outsider at this point, and more what people are really looking for is who is going to stand up as a viable candidate against Trump. I mean, I think that's almost more than the individual policies of these candidates. That's what the Democratic voters right now are measuring. That's how is this person going to look up on a stage next to Trump? Are they going to be able to take him down?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to some extent, there's kind of a double bind here because Trump is himself an outsider, right? That was his whole platform. So another outsider, you know, maybe they want the contrast of somebody who can say, I have more direct experience. I'm somebody who's been inside the system and I understand how it works and I can, you know, I can get in there and get things done. I'm not seeing a clear narrative on either side of that debate right now. And what it seems focused on for me is Democrats know they want someone who has a real viable chance of unseating the president.
We've got an email from Katie who says, we used to joke that there were so many candidates you could probably find one to shovel your driveway when it snowed. Now we have just as many, but it's harder to meet them. I tried to see Kamala Harris in Portsmouth, but couldn't get in, and tried earlier this week to reserve a space to see Pete Buttigieg, and both of his events were sold out. I think that's a sign, Karen says, that there's a lot of interest in these candidates, but someone needs to tell them that they need to find bigger venues or come back more often. Thanks, Katie. We really appreciate your email. And let's also hear from David in Hopkinton. Thank you very much for calling, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm confused about the terminology that this is such a large field of candidates. Typically, the primaries in New Hampshire have between 30 and 40 candidates on the ballot. So if there are 15 or 16 now, aren't we only halfway there?
Huh. Good question. Kevin, since you hunt,
David,
what do you think?
As you know, David, I mean, we've had more than 60 people file for president in the primary and a number of them aren't serious candidates. This is a very large field of very substantial candidates. That's one of the unique things here. But certainly going back to 2016, we had 16 very capable Republicans running for president. You often don't see this many serious candidates running against an incumbent who's seeking a second term, since it's very hard to defeat an incumbent who seeks a second term. I think it does speak to the enthusiasm that exists in the Democratic Party that resulted in so many victories in the midterms, motivating so many of these Democrats to think they've actually got a chance of knocking Trump off.
So, Dean, you were nodding. So maybe the qualifier is that we need to say a large field of serious candidates?
Yeah, and there's always a judgment call there and who gets to decide who's serious
right.
and who's not. You know, is Andrew Yang a serious candidate? Is Marianne Williamson a serious candidate or not? But there are others like Vermin Supreme and others that we've known for years. So you could have a primary, and I've seen this before, where maybe there are six or eight, quote, legitimate candidates, and then there'll be another 15 or 20 who pay the fee, and you know it's kind of a vanity thing. It's fun to be on the New Hampshire primary ballot, but Kevin's right. The ballot is always chock full of names in on both sides, but the distinction is kind of who are viewed as people who are viable, who have at least an outside chance at competing.
David, appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Briefly, other stories we've reported this week. The CEO of Newington-based gunmaker Sig Sauer is admitting he misled German export officials about the final destination of a shipment of pistols. Ron Cohen was accused of violating Germany's export laws. Cohen was given an 18-month suspended prison sentence and was fined $675,000 for his role in the cover-up. Also this week, we learned that New Hampshire is getting more than $2 million in grant money over 3 years to help run state environmental programs. The money from the EPA is going to the State Department of Environmental Services for programs related to air, water, and waste programs. And sticking with the theme of 2020, we should mention the news about former Vice President Joe Biden, who has not officially declared yet, but we learned that his habit of touching people in the way he thinks is affectionate is actually really creeping some people out. And he issued a response this week saying he will be much more mindful of people's boundaries. And he put out a statement on Twitter.
Social norms have begun to change. They've shifted. And the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset. And I get it. I get it. I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility.
So Joe Biden taking responsibility, not necessarily apologizing, but trying to take responsibility in some way. Dean, how have you seen Democrats here responding to this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, Joe Biden has kind of been legendary for his hands-on, touchy-feely politicking, and they had to have known, given all the discussion about President Trump and his issues, they had to have known that this was coming and that it would that people who don't want Biden to be the nominee would kind of pitch it as a form of sexual harassment. There's been a fascinating debate to watch within the Democratic Party, particularly among Democrats who believe the party is lurching too far to the left with progressive politics, Bernie Sanders and others. And those folks are very concerned that they believe Joe Biden is the only one who can beat President Trump. And I've heard them go to great lengths to try to separate out this Biden behavior from the hashtag MeToo behavior, that really trying to draw a bright line between kind of Biden's hands-on non-sexual politicking and Trump's accusations and the other MeToo accusations. And, you know, I think you can have a debate about whether or not, you know, Biden's behavior is still invasive. And, you know, you can have a debate over what the essence of the Me Too movement is. And does it include men invading women's personal space, even if it's not overtly sexual or not? But it's been fascinating to me to watch Democrats, I mean, really working overtime, those who want Biden to be the nominee, who believe the party is lurching too far to the left, really trying to pull him out of any situation where he's being painted with the Me Too brush, because they view that as potentially toxic. This is an issue for the Democratic primary. You know, given Trump's background, once you get to the general election, you know, it's a different story. Not that it would stop Trump from attacking him on this, but this is primarily an issue for him within the Democratic Party.
Well, it seems like the Democrats really want someone to be more or less bulletproof on this issue before they have them sort of debate one-on-one President Trump.
Sure, absolutely. But I think, again, I think the main concern is about people who believe he's the best option, and they're worried that he's going to be damaged and the party's going to end up with a much more progressive nominee that can't win in a general election.
They're also worried about, Dean, the fact that they feel this was a hit piece, that this was done
timed
right now in order to stop his momentum, even
sure.
before he gets in the race. We're talking about allegations over 4 or 5 years ago.
And it's been out for a long time.
They come out right now.
Yeah.
And there's viral video of Joe Biden putting his hands on women and kissing their hair behind them as they're standing at the podium. So why is this attack coming out now? That's why you're seeing the reaction.
Yeah.
And you talked about you want a candidate who's bulletproof, Peter. There's no such thing.
Well, I
asked. In 2020, everybody's imperfect. Every candidate's got dirty laundry.
Well, I meant
and
on
every
this
campaign,
issue.
No, on every campaign, it's about how you deal with that dirty laundry once it comes out, because it's inevitably going to come out. And I suspect, as we already know in this race, Joe Biden's not the only one who's dealing with sex harassment issues. Remember Bernie Sanders and the campaign of Bernie Sanders during the 2016
members.
Campaign
yeah.
about staffers feeling uncomfortable dealing with cohorts in the campaign. That how did that leak out? Right about the time when Bernie Sanders was saying, yeah, I'm definitely going to run for president again in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this move.
Kevin, do you sense that the Biden campaign was caught off guard by this, or not ready for it, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think they weren't ready for it, and they feel burned by it. It's clearly people who support Biden who suspect there are others already in this race who've engineered this attack on him.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about one more thing before we head into a break, which is something to do with the Republican Party, which is that Laura Trump, wife of President Trump's son, Eric, headlined a Republican Party fundraiser this week. What was her message? Dean?
She's very popular in the Republican Party. I think if you saw some video of her appearance, you would recognize her. She played a big role in the 2016 campaign. She's also now a senior advisor to the 2020 reelection campaign, so we're going to be seeing her around. She was here to fundraise for the state party. She spent some time attacking the media as being in the bag for Democrats, you know, the fake news line that we've all heard for some time now. And her argument also was that, Republican strategy should just be to stay out of the way because the Democrats are all going to destroy each other in this large primary that Kevin and I were just talking about, potential, you know, hit jobs and other things being maneuvered. So that seemed like she was a popular guest. They raised about $70,000. Like I said, we'll be seeing her around again because she is pretty actively involved in the campaign.
Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and still to come, investigators search a home in pursuit of an answer to a mystery that has lingered for 15 years, the disappearance of college student Maura Murray. Murray's disappearance is the subject of a podcast called Missing Maura Murray and has generated interest far beyond New Hampshire's borders. What do you think of the case and the investigation? The number to call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page where you can also watch a live video of this radio program. Just go to Facebook and search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. We'll be back in just a few. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Jackie Benson of Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan, reporter for the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital. We're talking about the week's news, and we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. We've got a few more stories to discuss, but before we close out the discussion of the 2020 presidential primary, I want to talk to John from Manchester, who called in during the break. Hey, John, thank you very much. You're on the air.
Thanks. Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I just thought it was interesting that Professor Scoliotis, being the political expert I heard on the other for a good decade, I suppose, would be so slanderous about the implying that the Sanders campaign has something to do with the Biden's own baggage. This is a candidate, Biden, who wasn't properly vetted by his own supporters. What do you think is going to happen when it starts coming forward about his son? His son's investments in Ukraine and China, and how people are going to feel about those things coming forward, other than knowing very well that these rumors weren't started by the Sanders campaign.
Well, I'd be interested in also shedding some sunlight on the allegations that you've raised, John. Those aren't things that I've particularly heard of. But I also don't know if I heard Dean link.
I'm happy to respond. But
yeah, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, no, I didn't mention Biden's campaign. I'm not sure what the caller is talking about. All I said was that I didn't mention the Sanders campaign. All I said was that the Biden campaign should have known this was coming. I mainly talked about the fact that my read on the debate with the Democratic Party is that people who support Joe Biden are very concerned that this could take him out, and they believe he's the only one who can really beat President Trump in a general election, that they believe the party has moved too far to the left. But I don't know who's behind this. We talked a little bit about with Kevin about how it was curious that this is all happening right now, but this doesn't strike me. I don't know who's behind it, but it doesn't strike me that this should be a surprise to anyone.
Yeah, but Kevin did mention that, and it was a fact. Kevin was correct that the Sanders campaign has been called out for some members of some staffers behaving inappropriately. That's an undisputed
fact.
That's
a separate issue. He was talking about Sanders and the 2016 campaign. Mm-hmm. And that's a separate issue from him. Nobody suggested that the Sanders campaign is behind the Biden. We discussed that it was curious that it's happening right now, but we don't know why that is or who's behind it.
But the fact of the matter, it's happening, and that's what sort of long primary season is
for.
And all
I said was that
shouldn't
be a surprise.
Discuss these things.
Well,
and
also the first person who came out with the allegations, Lucy Flores, the nominee for lieutenant governor, supported Bernie Sanders in the 2016 presidential campaign. And certainly reporters have made note of that, not that it necessarily has anything to do with the other, but that's a fact as well. Mm-hmm. But one thing John is right about, and that is Joe Biden's got other problems to deal with as he tries to get this nomination, other than how he's touchy-feely with women at public events. He's got a long record with a lot of votes and a lot of contradictions over that history. And certainly his son's dealings with Ukraine, there have been published reports about Biden was a point man in the administration dealing with Russia and Ukraine while his son was making money with his consulting firm advising certain people about Ukrainian policy with leaders over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got some other things to talk about, but I do appreciate, John, your calling in and sharing your thoughts with us. Really important that listeners do. If you want to, there's still time, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk about Brady Sullivan. NHPR's Annie Ropeek reported this week that the state is fining real estate developer Brady Sullivan $500,000 for breaking environmental regulations. So, Dean, what exactly was the offense here?
This was Brady Sullivan, this Mill West complex in Manchester, has been in the news for a while now. They were fined $500,000 for not properly testing soil that was removed from the site for contaminants. I believe it was stored somewhere else. They didn't test it properly. It's now been properly disposed of, but they're being penalized $500,000 nonetheless. And they were, I think, in 2017 for the same facility, they had a settlement with tenants dealing with lead paint and lead paint removal. So
that was unrelated, but
yeah. But it's been in this company and this building has been in the news for a while.
Yeah, they've had issues in Rhode Island as well with some of their buildings down there. I think it was also like mold and lead exposure issues. So they've definitely had their share of troubles.
Mm-hmm. Also this week, state investigators searched a house near the site of the disappearance of Maura Murray. Murray disappeared in 2004 after her car crashed in Haverhill, New Hampshire. Dean, why were investigators interested in this house? Do you recall?
This house has been under consideration for a while. I believe the family has wanted it searched carefully, and I think they even did some digging in the basement under the concrete, and the family said it was helpful, but they wanted some additional parts of the basement torn up as well. I mean, this has just been I remember this case. It's been 15 years now, this 21-year-old college nursing student at UMass hitting a snowbank in Haverhill and apparently talked to someone right afterwards and then was not there when police arrived at the scene. So it's been a big ongoing mystery, and I think, you know, these cold cases pop up periodically, and this was I think the family was hopeful that this search is something they had wanted for a while, and it just didn't pan out.
And the interest in this is huge. I mean, there's a podcast, Missing Maura Murray. I don't think anybody at this table's heard it. I've heard a few episodes, but it's like they're like literally like 99 episodes on this, and it's just it's been dissected publicly, every little detail. Jackie Benson, your thoughts?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of interest. Cold cases are always fascinating to people, but we've had a lot of interest in New Hampshire lately over the question of staffing for a cold case unit. So, I mean, that's been kind of a topic of debate. There was a bill this year that would have added two new full-time prosecutors to the cold case unit, because right now they have just a single attorney. They have, a couple full-time detectives, couple part-time. It's not a lot of staffing to handle this backlog of, you know, over 100 cold cases in the state. So that bill ended up getting tabled, but I think now that discussion is going to move into the budget, so it'll be interesting to see where that pans out.
Other stories we've reported on this week, Democrats in Congress want the Department of Veterans Affairs to compensate and treat vets with PFAS-related conditions identified by ongoing federal research. Their new bill is co-sponsored by New Hampshire Representatives Annie Custer and Chris Pappas. Minor league baseball season has begun. The New Hampshire Fisher Cats opened their season in Manchester with a loss. Binghamton beat New Hampshire 5-2. So, sorry, Fisher Cats, but the season is just beginning. There's still hope for them. Want to mention one more thing about PFAS. A new report is out on PFAS contamination at Pease. Seacoast Online reporter Jeff McMenemy reported that thousands of people working at Pease International Tradeport were exposed to water contaminated with PFAS chemicals from 1993 to 2014, and that exposure could cause a number of health problems, including cancer. That's according to a federal health agency statement in a recently released report. So, I mean, Dean, that it's news, but it's kind of like we felt like we might have already known that in some ways.
Yeah, right? It's been the conversation and the concern among people on the seacoast has been moving in this direction for some time. And we're talking about roughly a 20-year period from about 1993 to 2014. You know, there's concerns about breastfeeding children. There was a daycare center on the site. This is that, I think it's a foam firefighting retardant mm-hmm. That was used on the base. And so this been concerned for a while. This kind of confirms what people were worried about.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's end the show on sort of an uplifting kind of note. It's time. In other words, it's time for the animal story. So the Union Leader reported this week that Marlboro police stopped a woman Monday who was using a cell phone while driving with a baby goat in her lap and no license. And Monday, of course, was April Fool's Day. So kind of April Foolsy, but it was really no joke. This actually happened. Goats. Why? I guess that's like breaking the big rule, right? Never break more than one law at a time.
Good to have a license, too, when you're driving.
Good to have a license when you're driving, too. Is that a thing? I mean, I'm not originally from New Hampshire. Do people transport their goats a lot in their cars?
Well, we've had a serious debate in this state about banning pets on laps while driving. Yeah. There was a bill a couple years ago to try to do that. It was very controversial.
Where did that bill go?
I believe it was killed. Yeah. So it is still legal to drive with your pet in your lap.
Yeah, that wasn't a violation of what she was doing with the goat. It's just she had
everything
no
else was not good.
Right.
Yeah, the goat was fine.
Was it the goat that drew attention? Like they saw the goat's head hanging out the window or something?
Wouldn't it draw your attention?
Well, yeah, yes, but I guess yes. All right, so point taken. Okay, so let's look forward. I want to know what each of you will be watching news-wise next week. We'll start with you, Jackie.
It's all going to be the budget for me. I am going to be listening to the debate and that will be going on the House floor next week. And we are also seeing some of the bills that have already crossed over into the Senate are lined up for hearings. And so we'll be eavesdropping on that to see where the Senate's going to go with some of these big pieces of legislation that they've just been handed.
Kevin Landrigan.
Yeah, Josh had mentioned earlier in the show casino gambling and how the House has historically not approved it. Now that there are a lot of unanswered questions about the budget, we're going to take a serious look at whether minds may change in the House in order to get that revenue.
And Dean?
Yeah, as you mentioned, I'll be here on Monday to talk about the accidental presidents with Jared Cohen. I'm also going to be watching this Buttigieg visit this weekend to see if it gets the kind of big turnout and interest that seems to be building for it.
All right. Well, Dean, Kevin, Jackie, thank you very much for being here this hour. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Jackie Benson, editor at Citizens Count and the author of the fabulous novel, The Smoke Hunter. And she's got another one she says she's working on. We hope to have her on the bookshelf again soon. And Kevin Landrigan, reporter for the Union Leader. That is it for today. The conversation continues online, though, at Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Dan Tui is working the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.